The first one that got into the U-Haul business, remember that? American made, how about that? Well, this is Terrible Tommy, and it is the 11th month, first day of October, and it's Wotan's day, David Lane's favorite day, and here we are. Well, I guess it's time to register all of the U-Haul vans and all the trucks in the country as a possible guerrilla warfare weapon. I don't like to use the word terrorist because I think it's lost pretty much all of its meaning. They overuse the term so much it loses its meaning. But guerrilla warfare, yeah, it is a form of guerrilla warfare, and I've got a question for them. Why don't you ask them this? How come they ever never ask these questions of these people who pull this stuff off? Why don't they ask them, have you lost a relative to bombing in the Middle East? Have you lost a house to the U.S. forces kicking into your door and burning down a place? Have you lost a sister or a cousin in the Middle East that were at a wedding party and they droned them, killed them all? Could that be a reason why you're doing these things? I mean, let's be fair about this. They don't ever ask them that because that would lead to a different conclusion, that get the hell out of there and quit occupying countries. But they don't ask the right questions, and that's the right question. Did you lose any of your relatives to U.S. bombing or Russian bombing or British bombing in the Middle East? Did your house get burned down and blown up? Did you lose a leg or anything like that? Those are the questions they need to ask, but they're not going to ask those questions, are they, boys and girls? You know why? Because that would tend to bring bad thoughts about the military-industrial complex, and we can't have that because we know that the reason they do all these things is for our best interest and to protect the country, to protect the nations. They have to do this. They have to blow up all these countries and kill their leaders and everything. They got to do it. I mean, come on. Be fair about this. Well, normally, I don't comment on things, a lot of things happening across the pond, but four young men were reported to the judicial authorities over the weekend in Pisa, Italy, after 10 Italian citizens and 30 asylum-seeking criminals engaged in a mass brawl in what the local police described as a revenge attack by the Negro types migrants. The brawl took place on Saturday night when asylum seekers, you know, illegal aliens in the Sardinian city of Sassari, approached 20 Italian young men near the Datore Square. The fight occurred after an asylum seeker, an illegal alien, claimed that several Italians had beaten him and returned to the nearby asylum home on Solari Road, where he recruited another bunch of illegal aliens to get revenge on his alleged attacker. Police arrested 4 young men, including 2 asylum seekers, in connection with the brawl. Well, it sounds to me like the illegal aliens attacked the Italians, and then the cops arrest the Italians. A 19-year-old from Ivory Coast, I guess what color he was. An 18-year-old from Gambia, guess what color he was. And 2 20-year-olds from Sardinia. The situation was soon brought to a calm after police officers arrived at the scene. Officers found various weapons, including iron bars, in the possession of some of the participants, which have been passed on to investigators. Oh, they didn't have guns? You mean you can create violence without guns? Officials also say that they are working on CCTV footage from the area to identify others who were involved in the mass brawl. Just shades of the world to come, boys and girls. Just remember, chaos breeds division. Division breeds separation or racism. So you got to have one. First, you got to have the chaos, and we're getting plenty of chaos, but not enough. And you don't have to do it. You don't have to go out and do anything. It's naturally evolving. It's an evolutionary fact. My webmaster sent me a little clip here and some audio, which you may find interesting. I can't hear it because I've lost my playback from my storage, but I can see it's recording, so we'll play it for you. Scenario, this is a scenario where there are only 2 options, sending 20,000 troops who will die to Iran versus dropping a nuke on 200,000 Iranian citizens. Both scenarios cause Iran to give up. The option to send 20,000 troops is the best decision, as it would cause everyone to hesitate, if not stop the plan before sending in their family members. No one addressed this in the audio. Of course, there are never only 2 options, but that is not discussed here either. Here we go. Oops, I just saw that package is 12 megabytes. And we don't have time on the show to run 12 megabytes. We'll have to figure something else out. I know what I'll do. I'll send it out to you in an email, okay? I just see the Washington Times says that the Muslims will soon outbreed the Jews in this country. Well, they didn't quite figure that right, as the person who sent this to me says. Jews are a sub-race, not a religion, like they want you to think. Census figures only count those who admit they're Jews. Omitted are Catholic Jews, Protestant Jews, Muslim Jews, atheist Jews, and so on. It would be prudent to put their numbers between 20 and 30 million in the United States. Of course, they're technically and accurately, the Jews are not a race. But if they insist on making themselves some kind of a race, which makes them more of a target, that's okay with me. Like I said 30 years ago, the Jews are a conspiracy against all men. So they're conspirators more than anything else, a common herd of conspirators. Well, I see that Sam Clovis, a Trump campaign manager, reportedly testified before the Mueller grand jury. See, these guys either are too stupid or too treacherous to be trusted and testify before a grand jury, which nobody should ever testify before a grand jury. You should take the Fifth always, because a grand jury is nothing but a remaking of the old Star Chamber racket they had in Britain. And it's come right along and became the grand jury here in the United States. Don't ever testify. You're never going to help yourself by testifying before a grand jury. And this idiot that they're charging now, Papadopoulos, I guess, for lying to the FBI. When are these people ever going to take a little course in law that says you never lie to the FBI, you just take the Fifth, you don't talk? Now he's going to probably do jail time like Martha Stewart did, what, 3 or 4 years for lying to the FBI. Just don't answer their questions. Take the Fifth, God damn it.
One with mercy, he was dead. One with mercy, he was dead before he hit the floor. Who is he? Special Agent Terrence McGraw, counterintelligence unit out of Chicago, on special assignment for me. You ever hear of the group? No. They're a right-wing extremist cell. I'm not your usual anti-government fringe types. They've got deep pockets and influence. McGraw was getting close to revealing their leadership when he was taken out. The only member we've been able to get a visual on is this guy. Goes by the name of Radesky. McGraw had him pegged as the group's spotter in charge of recruitment. They can afford the best, mostly freelancers. Combination of ex-CIA and DOD operatives and hitmen.
So what do they want?
Same as any terrorist group. Power. To what end, we don't know. What we do know is, before McGraw was killed, he'd uncovered a plot to assassinate Senator Joseph Caton.
That's the guy running for president.
The one who will be president, if you believe the polls. Why Caton? McGraw couldn't provide any more details.
So what's your next move?
Nothing. I'm calling off the investigation. Come again?
That's right. As of today, the FBI is no longer investigating the group.
Okay, I'll get it.
You had a major conspiracy beef here, not to mention a dead agent, and what, you want to back off?
Officially, yes. Unofficially. There's a reason why McGraw's cover was blown. He was betrayed by someone in the bureau.
What, like a mole?
I could be wrong. I hope I am. But if I'm not, there's no one I can trust anymore. Except you. I trust you because I knew your father.
I trust you because I knew your father? Ha 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 ha. Oh boy, it was going pretty good until it got to that point. Well, even in a neighborhood packed with illegal aliens and so-called terrorists, all with their own customs, languages, foods, idiosyncrasies, there was something about Saifulo Saipo that his family that seemed not quite right. This is about the truck boy in New York City who's brought wonderful culture to the United States. And he's a credit to his neighborhood. With the benefit of hindsight, neighbors now believe that the 29-year-old Uzbek immigrant, not an immigrant, he's an invader, was plotting an attack long before he plowed his rented truck tank down a bike path in lower Manhattan, killing 8 people. Yeah, isn't that wonderful? 8 people had to pay for him coming to the United States. Yeah. 3 weeks before Tuesday's attack, a neighbor had noticed that Saipov frequently rented trucks like the one used in the attack. Quote, "This is the kind of truck you use for construction, but he wasn't doing construction," said Carlos Batista, 23, who noticed that one of the trucks was parked outside a vacant building. Wow. Why would you spend the money to rent this kind of truck and just leave it outside if you're not using it? Now I think he was practicing. I finally thought that over. Yeah. Others were uncomfortable with Sepal's wife, who wore a hijab. That's one of those headdresses. A Muslim garment that reveals only the eyes. Very convenient. Why you dress like a common criminal or a old West bank robber? Well, that's my religion. Don't challenge my religion. Other women among the many Muslims in the neighborhood wear simple headscarves, neighbors said. Well, this gal was a real devout gal. She wasn't going to wear just anything. Sepal and his wife Noxima Odilova, 23, moved about 15 months ago into a scuffy, seedy, low-rise, red brick building behind the mosque. They had two girls, one now 6 and another 4, and a baby boy who was born about 6 months later. We used to see him out back of the house, parading up and down with a Kalashnikov. No. The wife hardly went out. They were very mysterious, said Altana Dmitryskov, 63, a Macedonian invader who lives in the same building. See, that's where they're getting these neighborhoods so mixed up and screwed up that nobody knows anybody and nobody knows to say anything. And the more mixed up, the better, says the Jew boys. She said that the wife would watch through the curtains of her windows as the girls played in the front courtyard and would occasionally push the baby around the courtyard in a stroller. Sepal was the one who took the older girl to school. Quote, the girls didn't have friends. There were no parties, Dmitrovsky said. Language and cultural impediments kept the young family from befriending many people in the neighborhood. Don't you know that's what the government wants? That's what our oppressors want? They want a disjointed slob bunch of people that can't even communicate. But Sepal did have two friends, men who looked similar to him with long black beards, who were frequent visitors along with their wives and neighbors, and also they carried in large boxes into the apartment. We never thought anything about it. The wives dressed similarly to Sepal's wife, wearing the niqab, or however you pronounce that, which made them stick out in the neighborhood. Yeah, even in a screwed-up neighborhood like that, they stuck out. Over the summer, Batista got into a quarrel with two visiting men who yelled at him for riding a noisy dirt bike in the evening. Sepal, he said, came out of the apartment and patched up the argument. Actually, he was kind of a peacemaker, said Batista. He seemed pretty nice. After that, he would wave at me when he drove by. The Sepal family was last seen at the apartment complex over the weekend, neighbors said, suggesting that Sepal might have moved his wife to another location in anticipation of the attack, but he rented a pickup truck nearby at the Home Depot. Well, I always knew there was something wrong with Home Depot, didn't you? Well, didn't you see some of those symbols around on the wall? Yeah. Sepal immigrated to the United States in 2010 after winning what is called a diversity visa in a lottery designed to bring illegal aliens from underrepresented nations. In other words, now they've got unrepresented figures on the books. That there's not enough Iraqis in a town in New Jersey, or there's not enough blacks in a town in Tennessee. This is right out of the Communist Manifesto, really. Although he spoke into little English. And that, of course, that's what the Soviets did. They split people up all over the place so they couldn't properly communicate and form any kind of resistance. And that's what they want here. That's exactly what they want here. Although he spoke little English, he quickly started working as a truck driver and trying to start his own business. Plenty of capitalists will hire these people. Yeah, they work cheap. The year after his arrival, he registered his first company, Safe Motors. Well, there you go. That's enough of that bullshit. We know how that works. In other words, anybody can come in here from any place, from any background, and do anything they want. And you're not going to stop them. They don't give a shit. Trucks, motorcycles, bicycles, Volkswagens, don't matter. They can run over people, make perfect weapons. And if it was really done properly, they'd never get caught. I think most of these guys down deep want to get caught because they're sacrificing for their beloved Allah. Yeah. But let's not worry about that, boys and girls. Let's make sure we get to the ball game tonight, because it's going to be a big deal, man. The Houston guys against the Los Angeles guys. The Houston niggers against the Los Angeles niggers. And a few white guys thrown in there. Because if they'd get rid of all the white guys, they'd have a little attendance problem. Well, there's hundreds of outfits now to stamp out hate and intolerance. They're everywhere. But you know what it is? It's just a dodge to keep the people's minds off the real enemy, and that is Washington, the military-industrial complex, and the financial system, the bankers and so forth. But that's why the system sort of promotes this anti-hate stuff. It's to keep people's mind off what's really going on and screwing things up. They got a project here. 2016 election left many Americans afraid of intolerance and the violence it can inspire. Oh, the need for trustworthy facts on the details and the frequency of hate crimes and other incidents born of prejudice has never been more urgent. Well, it's terrible. Got to keep an eye on them. At this point, there is simply no reliable national data on hate crimes. Well, we're going to get some. And no government agency documents lower-level incidents of harassment and intimidation. We want every little thing, man. If a guy stubs his toe on the wrong brick on the street, it's hate. It's hate. It's all hate. Now, of course, wars all over the world, American troops being in almost every country in the world, and in many of those countries, they're killing the leaders and killing the people. That's okay. Yeah. Documenting and understanding all of these incidents, from hate-inspired murders to anti-Semitic graffiti to racist online trolling, requires new, more creative approaches. You see how well this fits into the system program? This is really pro-system. But they'll say, oh, this system's fascist. Yeah. That's why we have marshaled a national coalition of news organizations, civil rights groups, and technology companies intent on creating a database of reporting hate crimes and bias incidents. Well, you can report all you want to, but it's not going to stop what's going on. ProPublica is an independent, non-profit newsroom that produces investigative journalism in the public interest. In addition to us, the project's growing list of partners include the Google News Lab, Univision, that's the Mexicans, the New York Times opinion section, New York, WN New York, YC, BuzzFeed News, First Draft, Medin, New American Media, The Root, Latino USA, and The Advocate, and USHADI. We're also working with civil rights groups such as the Southern Millionaires Law Center and Morris D's. And schools such as the University of Miami School of Communications. Boy, you're really going to change the world. Change the world, man. We will, for the first time, be able to take a rigorous look at hate crimes in America, combining data analysis social media, news gathering, and ambitious investigative storytelling. It won't tell all the stories about the Negroes killing white people. No, raping white women. No, that's not part of it, because that's actually not hatred. That's just social manipulation. You can follow along with the project on Facebook or Twitter. Another couple of culprits. We'll use these to share good journalism about hate crimes and let you know what the partners in our project learn all along the way. If you've got tips on your neighbor you think we should share, definitely let us know. Well, thank you, buddy. And they've got these groups, Human Rights Campaign, Southern Poverty Law Center, the Defecation League, Matthew Shepard Foundation, the Council on American Islamic Relations. I don't see anything in here about being anti-war, being against the wars in the Middle East, where if you want to really help non-white people, wouldn't you want to not have wars over there and kill their leaders? What do you think about that? They seem to be this one-trick pony, man. The FBI is required by law to collect data about hate crimes. Yeah. But local jurisdictions aren't required to report incidents up to the federal government. Oh my God, we got to change all that. As a predictable consequence, the FBI's data is incomplete. We don't have everybody on the list. We're assembling a trove of data provided by law enforcement, community groups, local jurisdictions, news reports, search trends, social media, and other nonprofit organizations. Volunteers, including journalism students throughout the country, will follow up, fill in data, and authenticate the social media reports. Our database will be available with privacy and security restrictions to civil rights groups and journalists, to enrich a national understanding and conversation about hate crimes and bias incidents. Boy, we're going to really set things up. Documenting hate is modeled on our pioneering 2016 Election Land Project, monitoring what happened to voters at the polls. Oh. Victims. Have you been a victim or witnessed a hate incident? Telling your story is important. Your contribution enables you, civil rights groups, and reporters to get a clearer picture of what's happening, actually happening, enabling us to work on the problems at hand. We'll treat your information with utmost care. If you've got an incident or experience to share, please go to this form and fill it out and send it to us, giving us your address and everything else so that if we get upset with you, we can come out and kill you. Journalists, reporters at local news outlets in the United States, TV, radio, online, and print, can sign up to receive data and story leads to follow up on the report. See, that's why you have to be a lone wolf, boys and girls. They won't have anything to report. You'll get real-time alerts about hate crimes, reporting recipes, tips, and invitations to join community calls. We'll also promote stories you write using your data on the Documenting Hate site and the social media programs. Wow, man, this is getting interesting. I think I'll join. Civil rights groups. If you're a civil rights group or a service organization serving vulnerable communities, I think that's the white working communities, and you gather incidents about hate crimes against whites and bias harassment, we'd like to talk about data sharing. We want your information. Snitch on your neighbor. Both getting your data into our trove, but also in giving you access to data relevant to your service mission. If you aren't collecting stories but would like to, you can contact us to receive tools and guidance. Wow. If you look at the early Bolshevik propaganda, you're going to see the same type of writing. This is the same goddamn kind of writing the Bolsheviks were putting out when they were gathering up names and everything to stand people up against the wall or to starve them out. Of course, it's all done for a good thing, a good cause, you know, good cause. On November 15th, a week after the election, we announced the launch of this initiative in a post. Hate crimes are up, way up. They're uncontrollable, but the government isn't keeping good track of them. No, that must make them fascists. All them people up there in the government are fascists. Besides that, they're Republicans. Since then, we've written about a surge in visits to white supremacist websites, an interview with a scholar of the far right, the New York Police Department's rare diligence in tracking hate crimes, and a first-person account of hate crimes in our own reporter's backyard. Here is a running list of stories from the ProPublica and our partner organizations. Well, holy, holy, holy. Here's a few of some of our good articles. Racist Violence Unpunished, a White Hate Group's Campaign of Menace. InfoWars, Inside the Left's Online Efforts to Out White Supremacists. Racist Vandalism, apparently targeted at Pittsburgh Steelers coach Mike Tomlin, not removed for days after request. Another article, we found 154 incidents of hate speech and violence at colleges nationwide since last fall. Greencastle man spots hanging noose on way to work. Boy, call out the National Guard on that one. Hate report tracking a wave of swastikas across the country. Oh my God, it's Berlin 1936 all over again. I stood up for hate. That's another article. Have you experienced hate speech on Facebook? We want to hear from you, because we snitch everybody off that says the wrong thing on Facebook. It's amazing how many stupid people play around on Facebook, put personal things on there. Here's another article. All the swastikas and broken glass since Charlottesville. Pro-Russian bots take up the right-wing cause after Charlottesville. When hate meets hoax. That must have to do with the H word. Despite disavows, leading tech companies help extremist sites monetize hate. Is that why they shut down a whole bunch of our sites? Track news stories about hate with documenting hate news index. They're pumping out a lot of shit, man. But it won't make a bit of difference, except it'll make it worse for them in the end. Spurned by major companies, the Daily Stormer returns to the web with help from a startup. Another one, here are the hate incidents against mosques and Islamic centers since 2013. Well, this goes on and on and on, and hundreds of these articles they've written about the terrible, terrible haters in the country. You just don't know what you're doing out there, boy. You got to love everybody. Yeah. Is that why there's so many people on the street, homeless? I figured these people would take them in. But they're not taking them in. Left-wingers or Bolsheviks are not taking the people off the street and taking them into their homes. They cry about them. They call everybody else a fascist because they're out there. But they're not taking them in. I wonder why. One guy interviewed back east in New York City, a neighbor of this truck driver that ran over people. He said, I saw all these guys with long black beards dressed in black carrying bags into the guy's house. We thought they were having Tupperware parties. That was the word in the neighborhood. We couldn't believe anything else. They were just having Tupperware parties. Well, I guess the truck boy, he planned to continue his killing spree on the Brooklyn Bridge. But he jumped out of the truck with a paintball gun and another fake gun. What the hell was that all about? He didn't even have a real gun with him. Well, I see the famous but incompetent interviewed this bird back in 2015. 2015, they interviewed him.
Mr. Muslim there, will you answer a few questions?
I'll call you. Okay.
Do you plan any nasty action in this country now that you've come here?
No, not me. Not me. I'm good boy.
Oh, we're very happy to hear you're a good boy. We'll take that back to the director, and file it because we know you're a good, loyal American boy, and you wouldn't damage the hair on anybody's head, right?
You got that right.
Okay, it's been a real good thing getting to know you, and we'll tell all the boys down at the Quantico that you're a fine individual.
Let's give a little respect to Revelo P. Oliver, one of the finest racial intellectuals that we've ever had. Too far, too bad he's gone. Dr. Revelo Pendleton Oliver is rightly regarded by those few lucky enough to be familiar with his work as one of the greatest Americans of the century. Born in 1908, he quickly rose through the ranks of the Academy to become one of the leading philologists and classical scholars of his time. He was a professor of the classics at University of Illinois, Urbana campus, for 32 years. He could easily have spent his life cloistered in his study, doing what he loved best, applying the lens of scholarship focused by his brilliant mind upon the dusty tomes and manuscripts of the past, but he chose a different path. He saw clearly that long before most of his countrymen were subversive and alien elements were leading his people, and he chose to risk reputation and social position to speak out. From 1954 until his death, August 1994, he worked almost without ceasing for the awakening of the Americans of European descent to their danger and their possible great destiny. Dr. Oliver delivered this address to a German-American group assembled at the Lorelei Club in Hamburg, New York, near Buffalo, on 9th of June 1968. The typescript was lost in a flood in 1990 at Dr. Oliver's home, but has been restored by your editor to be printed form based upon the original tape recording made by Mr. Everett Weibert. Any errors introduced in the article are, of course, the editor's and not Dr. Oliver's. This is one of Dr. Oliver's finest speeches, and it's certainly his most comprehensive short work. I'm not going to be able to read this all today, but we'll finish it later on. Ladies and gentlemen, let me thank you first for all the honor of your invitation and the pleasure of being with you today. In the past dozen years, I have spoken before a great many conservative and patriotic organizations, but this is the first time that I have appear before a society that is specifically German, that is to say, composed of descendants of the part of our race that stayed home in the 5th century while their kinsfolk conquered and occupied all the western territories of the largely mongrelized, moribund Roman Empire that their more remote kinsfolk had founded more than 1,000 years before. As I understand it, I'm speaking to a closed meeting of our members and of guests of whom they have confidence. I believe that it is stipulated that what is said here today is off the record and not for publication in any form, and that there are no reporters present. On that understanding, I shall give you candidly and without circumlocution location the best estimate of our present plight that I have been able to make. Some of you may remember the old story about the college girl who went to bed one night and finally dropped off to sleep, but in the early hours of the morning she heard the clock strike 2, and she felt the door of her room was slowly opening. Terrified, she tried to call out in the darkness, but a handkerchief was whipped over her mouth, and she felt strong arms lift her from the bed. She was carried downstairs, thrown into a tonneau of a large and luxurious Rolls-Royce, and set off at high speed. After a long ride, she was lifted out and carried into the large hall of a vast palatial mansion, up marble stairs and into the elegantly appointed room, where she was thrown on the bed. Only then did she see her captor clearly. He was a strong and handsome man, attired in faultless evening dress. He stood by the bed, looking down at her spectacularly and silently. She tried to speak, and at last she was able to say whimperingly, quote, what are you going to do to me? Unquote. The man shrugged his shoulders. Quote, how should I know, he said, this is your dream. Unquote. The story is absurd, of course, but it owes what little humor it possesses to the equivalency play on the mystery of our own consciousness. A dream is, by definition, a series of sensations that occur in the brain when both our senses of perception and our powers of will and reason are in abeyance, so that we have no control over the flux of sensations. But it is, of course, a well-known phenomenon that when we dream that we are dreaming, the dream ends and we awaken. Then the conscious mind takes over, and we are again responsible for our thoughts, and must face a day in which we must be responsible for our actions, which by their wisdom or folly may determine the rest of our lives. Our dreams may give expression, pleasant or painful, to our subconscious desires or fears, but in the waking hours we must, if we are rational, make our decisions on the basis of the most objective and cold-blooded estimates that we can make. Estimates of the forces and tendency in the world about us, estimates in the realities with which we must deal, remembering always that nothing is likely to happen just because we think it's good, or unlikely to happen just because we think it's evil. If ever we have had need to appraise carefully and rationally our position and prospects, the time is now. In the outer quadrangle of Brasenose at Oxford, if I remember correctly, there is in the middle of the green sward a solitary sundial whose bronze plate bears the chilling inscription, quote, it is later than you think, unquote. I assure you, my fellow Americans, that it is now later, much later than you think. It is possible, of course, that it may now be too late, and that, as a veteran observer and distinguished friend of mine recently assured me, our cause is now as hopeless as was of the South after the fall of Richmond and near the tragic conclusion of the Second War for Independence, which was fought on our soil. I honestly believe, however, we still have some chance of survival. If I did not believe that, I certainly would not be speaking to you today or asking you to consider with me the odds against us. I may be wrong. I have no powers of divination, not of prophecy, and I certainly do not know the secret plans of our enemies or even the inner structure of their organization. I can only guess the probable extent of their power and the probable efficiency of their strategy by area pollution. From what they have thus far accomplished, I can only give you my best estimate made after long and anxious consideration, but I do not pose as an expert in these matters, And since I have promised to be candid, I will tell you candidly that my estimates in the past proved to be overly optimistic. When I left the mephitic atmosphere of Washington late in 1945, I had no great misgivings about the future of our nation. On the basis of the best estimates I could then make, I was confident that our future was assured by a popular reaction which I deemed inevitable within the next 5 years. I felt certain that the secrets of Washington would quickly become known and that our nation would be swept with moral indignation and revulsion when Americans saw exposed to the light of day even a small part of the foul record of the deceased creature that had squatted in the White House for so many years, surrounded by his appalling gang of degenerates, traitors, and alien subversives. I knew that the secret of Pearl Harbor would be quickly disclosed, and that Americans would soon know how the Japanese had been maneuvered and tricked into destroying our fleet and killing so many of our men. I was sure that the public would soon learn of the old conspiracy between Roosevelt and Churchill, who was at the time a private citizen in what was still Great Britain, and also of Roosevelt's persistent efforts in 1936 and 39 to get started in Europe this insanely fratricidal war that devastated that continent, that destroyed so much of what is the most precious and irreplaceable treasure of any race, the genetic heritage of its best men. And that inflicted upon our own country a great squandering of life and wealth in a war that was deliberately conducted to assure the defeat of the United States and Britain, no less than that of France and Germany. I was sure that we would quickly, once peace had come, see what we had fought for, the sole purpose of imposing the beast of Bolshevism on a devastated land. I was sure that we would quickly see the nature of this great treason trap called the United Nations. I thought that decent men's stomachs would turn when they learned of the officially admitted strategy of the British government, which, in deliberate violation of all convention or civilized warfare, had initiated the vicious bombing of unprotected German cities for the express purpose of slaughtering so many defenseless German civilians, that the German government would be forced to bomb unprotected British cities and slaughter enough helpless British civilians to work up in Great Britain some enthusiasm for a suicidal war that British government was imposing on its reluctant people. The first example in history, I believe, of a government at war deliberately having its own citizens massacred for the purpose of propaganda. I thought that the truth about such domestic outrages as the infamous sedition trial in Washington would necessarily become known and excite the feelings that such crimes must excite in the breasts of decent men. And I was sure that 1,000 other infamies, unsurpassed and only rarely revealed or equaled in recorded history, would be disclosed, with the result that all the steamships outwardly bound from our shores would within a few years be crowded to their very rails with hordes of vermin desperately fleeing from the wrath of an aroused, angry nation. In 1945, I really believed that by the year 1952, no American could hear the name of Roosevelt without shudder, or utter it without a curse. You see, I was wrong. I was right about the inevitable exposure, like bodies of the Polish officers who were butchered in Katyn Forest by the Bolsheviks. As we know, at the time, many of the Roosevelt regime's secret crimes were exposed to the light of day. The exposures were neither so rapid or so complete as I anticipated, but their aggregate is far more than should have been needed for the anticipated reaction. Only about 80% of the secret of Pearl Harbor has thus been thus far become known, but that 80% should in itself be enough to nauseate a healthy man. Of course, I do not know, and I may not even suspect, the full extent of the treason of that incredible administration, but I should guess that in at least half of it has been disclosed in print somewhere, not necessarily in well-known sources, but in books and articles in various languages, including publications that the international conspiracy tries to keep from the public, and not necessarily in the form of direct testimony, but in at least in the form of evidence from which any thinking man can draw the proper and inescapable deductions. The information is there for those who will seek it, and enough of it fairly well known, fairly widely known, and especially the Pearl Harbor story, to suggest to anyone seriously interested in the preservation of his country that he should learn more. But the reaction never occurred, and even today the common used 6-cent postage stamp bears the bloated and sneering visage of a great war criminal, and one hears little protest from the public. Why? It is true that there were some faint and feeble beginnings of reaction, especially when Senator Joseph McCarthy began his famous series of hearings before the Senate Subcommittee on Internal Security. All that those hearings produced was but a small trickle leaking through the vast dike of official secrecy that held back the ocean of evidence that the United States had been stealthily captured by aliens and by traitors in their employ. But when dikes begin to leak, they soon break, and when the McCarthy hearings started only a little later than I had predicted, I said to myself, "This is it, at last. This is the beginning, and soon will begin a great exodus of panic-stricken rats fleeing from a just retribution." But I was wrong again. Instead, a friend of mine was right. He was at the time a member of the Central Intelligence Agency, which at that time included some Americans, and he happened to be in Wheeling, West Virginia on the 9th of February, 1950, when Senator McCarthy made his famous speech in which he stated that there were 57 members of the Communist Party or of the Soviet espionage apparatus in the State Department in positions of responsibility, and that the State Department knew that they were there. After the speech, my friend found an opportunity to talk to McCarthy alone. He told him, "Senator, you said there were 57 known communists in the State Department? If you had access to the files in my agency, you would know that there is absolute proof that there are 10 times that many. But, Senator, you do not realize the magnitude and the power of the conspiracy you are attacking. They will destroy you. They will destroy you utterly." But Senator McCarthy merely shook his head and said, "No, the American people will never let me down," unquote. He was wrong, too, you see. It's not necessary here to rehearse the steps by which McCarthy was destroyed. He was, of course, sabotaged from within his own staff. He had Roy Cohn, a Jew homosexual, on his staff, and he had Bobby Kennedy. The aliens who control our press and radio and the boob tubes spattered their slime over the country. Swarms of ignorant and neurotic little shysters, whom we call intellectuals, issued from the doors of the colleges and the universities, shrieking and spitting as it was their wont. And all that had its effect, but the conspiracy was able to silence Joe McCarthy only by a somewhat less routine operation. They found an army officer who had been a military failure until Bernard Baruch promoted him to general, and who in 1945 should have been able to hope for nothing better than that he would escape a court-martial and thus avoid being cashiered if he could prove that all the atrocities and all the sabotage of American interests of which he had been guilty of in Europe had been carried out over his protest and under the categorical orders of the president. The conspiracy took that person, and with the aid of their press, they did a quick masquerade job and dressed him up as a conservative. They wrote speeches that he was able to deliver without too much bumbling. They displayed his grin on all the boob tubes, and they elected him president. And of course, Ike was elected with a mandate from his masters to stab Senator McCarthy in the back, and he did. And so the conspiracy plugged that small leak in the dike. But how was it able to do that? Oh, yes. We could trace the whole operation step by step. We know that our enemies are sneaking and cunning. We know that they command the wealth of the world, including whatever the United States Treasury, and through the income tax, whatever's in your pocket and mine. They can hire stupid and unprincipled Americans to do anything for them and to act as front men. But the real question before us is not their cunning and their innate evil. The deeper, more important, and far more unpleasant question is what was and is wrong with the American people that made them and is still making them willing victims of their enemies. Some years ago, it was customary for fast-talking confidence men to find some chump with $5,000 or $10,000 to cash and sell him the Brooklyn Bridge or the Holland Tunnel. And I hear that when the Pennsylvania Railroad began to demolish its station in New York City, someone bought it for $25,000 cash. Now the swindlers in all those cases are undoubtedly wicked men. They deserve exemplary punishment. But you know, there must have been something wrong with the purchasers, too. Much as we may sympathize with them, we shall have to agree, I think, that they were not overly bright. We Americans, you know, are regarded with supreme contempt by our enemies, who describe us in private and sometimes public most unceremonious terms. You may remember that some years ago, a man named Khrushchev was manager employed on the conspiracy estate in Russia. He was invited to this country by his pal Ike. And he toured our land, honored and applauded by the press and even some Americans. Soon after his return, he told newspaper reporters in Vienna, quote, "The Americans, why, you spit in their face and they think it's the dew," unquote. That delicate phraseology reminded me of what I had been told by an acquaintance in Washington during the Second World War. This man, a veteran journalist, held a position of importance in one of the lie factories operated by the Roosevelt regime to keep the boobs pepped up with enthusiasm for sending their sons or husbands to a senseless slaughter. At one policy conference, this man objected to a proposed lie on the grounds that it was so absurd that it would destroy public confidence, with the result that the Americans would soon cease to believe anything that the agency manufactured. There was a great deal of debate over that question in his policy conference until it was ended by the agency's great expert in such matters. He was a man who, by the way, for some reason or other, had left Germany a few years before to come and to bless the United States with his presence. His expert, being a bit ruffled by the debate, finally took his elegant little cigar from his mouth and said decisively, "We spit in the faces of the American swine," and that settled it. The master had spoken. Why do you receive and deserve such contempt unless we have simply degenerated into a race of imbeciles, unfit to survive in the world? There must be some ascertainable mental block that makes us so gullible. And if so, we must urgently need to identify it. That's the real reason why I brought up the question of Senator McCarthy and what may have seemed history long past in a toise. That episode was obviously the antecedent of our present terrible plight, and when we try to look back at the obvious factors such as the alien control of our channels of information and our finances, we know that there must be something back of that. And then we looked at an obvious factor of which many were made aware only recently by the shocking behavior of so-called students in the so-called universities, by the far more shocking behavior of the administrative officers and faculties of those diploma mills. We now see that the gang of sleazy racketeers headed by John Dewey has attained its goal. We realize that public schools have been for many years a vast brainwashing and brain contaminating machine that has worked on the whole with a great efficiency. It's a machine to which we send our children to have their minds filled with grotesque and debased superstitions, to have their instincts of integrity and honor leached from their souls, to be incited to premature debauchery and perversions, to be imbued with thoughtless irresponsibility, and to prepare for addiction to mind-controlling drugs and existence below the animal level. The public schools have indeed been the most powerful single engine of subversion that our enemies have used upon us. The rest of this hour would not suffice even to enumerate the ways in which these self-styled educators have accomplished their deadly work. When we go back to the affair of Senator McCarthy and look for a deeper cause, we can, of course, blame the schools, which were doing then a little less openly the work that they're doing now. But that leaves us with the question, why did the American people fall for that racket? Why were they gullible enough to be so easily taken in by John Dewey's hoax? Well, let us go back to 1917 when the Dewey fraud gained control of only a relatively small area, when the world was certainly a brighter and more pleasant place. That brings us, of course, to the time of Woodrow Wilson, another baleful figure in our history. I'm not only the one of those who regard Wilson as entirely a villain. I think he was primarily a man who could intoxicate himself with his own words, and I think he went through the most of his life mistaking his hallucinations for reality, as surely as he did on the day of 1919 when he was driven in the early morning through the deserted streets of Washington, mechanically raising his hat and bowing to the applauding crowds that existed along his feverish brain. I am therefore willing to believe that he believed a good deal of what he said, and although in his political life he was merely a marionette that danced and pranced on the stage as its strings were pulled by Jacob Schiff, Bernard Baruch, and the Warburgs, and their agent Colonel House, the fact remains that Wilson ranted to the American people about making the world safe for democracy and a war to end wars, and they believed him instead of calling a physician when he began babbling that errant nonsense. They let him plunge them into a war in which they had no conceivable concern, and to use the power of the United States to make the result of that war as disastrous in the long run for Britain as it was for Germany. Now, I admit that the notion of a warless world is a pleasant, attractive thought, but people who believe that there can be such a thing should ask if Santa Claus, in whom they doubtless also believe. Let us go back to 1909, when the American people were offered a plan for destroying nations that had been formulated again by a filthy degenerate named Mordecai, alias Karl Marx. Now, it is true that the promoters hired a few journalists, liberal professors, and other intellectual prostitutes to prove conclusively that the purpose of the income tax could never, under any circumstances, exceed 4% on the income of millionaires and could never affect anyone else, for the obvious reason that no federal government could possibly spend so much money. But that point is that the majority of the American people, the inheritors of a free government based on the premise that that government must be limited to essentials, must be tied down by the chains of the stringent constitutions restraining the exercise of all powers except those deemed absolutely necessary for national defense. Those American people believed that hogwash, in effect, what the promoters were telling them in Wheeling, West Virginia tones. Come little boobies, put your heads into the noose and we'll do you lots of good, unquote. And the boobus little boobies stuck their necks in the noose, and so the country is now under the regime of the Great White Slave Act, and that's why we are where we are today. We could go much further back, and if we had the time, we certainly could go back at least to the 18th century and the weird mythology of what is now called liberalism and all the basic lies that are rammed into the mind of our children in the schools were manufactured by a motley and bizarre gang composed of agents of Weishaupt's Great Conspiracy, many ordinary swindlers and the mountebanks, and quite a bevy of idealists with buzzing brains and twittering tongues. But I think we have said enough to see that the Americans are suffering from chronic disease of tropism that has invariably placed us at the mercy of our enemies by making us incapable of taking thought for ourselves. There is in us a weakness, perhaps a fatal weakness, that makes us not only listen to the babble of self-professed do-gooders, but do whatever they tell us to do, and to do it as mindlessly as though we were in a hypnotic trance and had surrendered our will to that of hypnotists. Now, I believe that this strange weakness, unlike so many of our peculiarities, is not a single congenital and hereditary idiocy. If that were true, then we would not be here. Our remote ancestors would have been eaten long before the dawn of history. It is compounded, it seems to me, of a perversion of seven different qualities, a perversion affected and fostered by certain misunderstandings in the peculiar circumstances that result from prosperity, power, and world dominion we of the West achieved for ourselves and enjoyed in recent centuries. All of the seven elements of our mentality that I shall enumerate are good qualities, at least in the sense that they are born in us, that we could not eliminate them from our genetic heritage if we wanted to, and that we have perforce to accept them. We could comment at length on each of them, and it would be particularly interesting to contrast ourselves with other races at each point, but I must list them as briefly as possible with only a word or two of explanation to make our meaning clear. The first is imagination, which is highly developed in us and vivid, an imagination which means, among other things, that we have a spiritual need to great literature, both literature of a vicarious experience and literature of a fantastic and marvelous that transcends the world of reality. But this gift bears with it, of course, the danger that we may not distinguish clearly between the vivid imagination and something that we can actually see in the world. Second, the sense of personal honor, which is so strong in us and seems so fatuous and silly to other races. It is this, among other things, that gives us conception of honorable contests when men of our race meet as opponents in war. It gives us a knightly ethos that you see when Diomedes and Clausius met on the plains of Troy, and in all subsequent history, the story of our race. It also exposes us to the dangers of behaving in knightly fashion to those whom those standards are lunacy. And that's it for today. I'll finish this tomorrow. Revelo P. Oller, one hell of a man.